Come back, your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back. Some of you may be too young to remember that, but believe it or not, so am I. I guess at some point after Welcome Back, Cotter was canceled in the 1840s, I heard enough of the theme song to have it live rent-free in my head for, like, the rest of my natural days. Well, we split utilities, so it's not rent-free, and frankly, I enjoy the company. Regardless, welcome back to And Volume for All, a deeply reverent and something-something greatest music in the history of the world, heavy metal. I am your United States host guard, Quinn. And you're going to be glad that I'm patrolling these choppy waters today because we are dipping our collective tootsies back into the kiddie pool of my painfully limited historical knowledge with part three of our series on World War I as told through the lens of musicians who've largely chosen to disappoint their parents.
Bobby Darin never had to dress like a Halloween goblin to sell records.
I mean, if you're gonna make black metal, could you at least put some effort into the production side? I understand you boys were inspired by the aesthetic of low-fidelity genre-defining masterpieces like Transylvanian Hunger, but my god, Lord Magnus Violator, that album came out 30 years ago! I understand what it means to be true cult, but you just don't sound like the ancient evil of the Hidden North. Not that I can tell. I'm just glad that your father isn't alive to hear you overusing the flat fifth like this. If you ask me, it's that older boy in the band, the bassist. What's his name? Yeah, Saint Tannic. He doesn't fool me. I knew him when he was just Greg. I suppose you and Mr. Saint Tannic think there's something wrong with playing in a melodic minor scale once in a while? You know what? I don't want to argue anymore. You're just upsetting me. I'm going to go get ready for church burning. Wow, that was not what I was expecting her objections to be. Anyway, if you missed the last 25 minutes of the last episode, lucky you. That was awful. It turns out, war is kind of sad. But hopefully there were just enough glimmers of humanity peeking through the clouds of chlorine gas to remind us all that light can exist, even in the blackest of trenches. And the little musical mashup that I played for you at the end of that episode and just now at the top of this one contain, I think, both ends of the visible spectrum, even if one is only implied. We began by returning to the French black metal septet. Hey. I don't know why I did that. It's not a sex joke. It doesn't even sound like a sex joke. FT-17, with the album closer to their 2016 LP titled Marcellin Goes to War. It's a concept album based on the diary of a French soldier named Marcellin Trouveau. Four tracks on the album are just excerpts from the actual diary read aloud, and I would play them for you, but they're in French, and I don't speak French, so now neither do you. But I will just read a bit of the first entry, written on August 3rd, 1914. It's the war. A telegram confirmed the news which has surprised no one. It's the war. There is no doubt that it will be glorious. Everyone around me is convinced that we will spend Christmas in Berlin. I decided to write to bear witness to the event, but having no one to correspond with, I will blacken my diary for future descendants. My name is Marcellin Trouveau. In civilian life, I'm a teacher in a small Charente village. I should have taken my class for this school year just after returning from military service, but it's the war, so kids will probably have to do without me for a while. An improbable journey awaits me, a revenge for France. I look great in my uniform, with sparkling eyes and a neat mustache. I have immortalized the moment on glossy paper. What a shame that this photo is for no one. God damn it, even the happy shit is fucking sad. I couldn't actually find out what happened to Marcellin during World War I, but I think we can all just assume that he made it until we hear otherwise. The lyrics to the final track on the album read like this. Tonight, a hero has fallen. Oh, okay, so he didn't make it. Probably start reading these scripts ahead of time. I'll start over. Tonight, a hero has fallen with a bullet to the broken heart. His final journey will take him toward his last trench. We then move on to Gas Mask by the Ukrainian Black and Death Doom band 1914, who, along with Meinenwerfer, have dedicated their entire discography to World War I, and who I really shouldn't love the way that I do. The death metal growl of the vocals are probably my least favorite variety of harsh, but something about the depth and specificity of 1914 really resonates with me. I also may have accidentally tripped and fallen directly onto a marijuana cigarette before listening to this song, and boy did that riff come to life. You know, somebody should really look into the relationship between THC and heavily distorted guitar tone. There might be something there. Here are the lyrics to the section that you heard. Empires burning, destruction and death as homecoming. Back to the trenches. Straighten up your rifle. Get back in line. Give up your life for empire. Death is not the end. Gas mask on my face. Again, I chose these four songs for their parallel subject matter, and only after the fact did their parallel themes make themselves plainly obvious, probably because I was high. On accident, which is a great side project by Matt Pike of Sleep, by the way. High on accident. Accident, I said. The Last Trench posits World War I as the end of Marcellin's journey, whereas 1914 points directly to the irony of the command to give up your life for empire, because as the soldiers have been assured, death is not the end. But it is, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure it is. I couldn't find lyrics for the next song, Trenchfoot, that comes off of a 2018 World War I themed EP titled Ypres by the Welsh sludge band out of Cardiff, Tides of Sulphur. But in keeping with the themes here, one can clearly make out the refrain, "Only the dead have seen the end of the war." And before we return one final time to the last trench, we briefly revisit the Belgian black metal band Suntold, who you heard on the previous episode, with a conclusion to a track titled Suicide in the Trenches. This song goes about as far into the Stygian pit of Satan's nightmares that is trench warfare as I think I can go. It's ugly and brutal and just unapologetically dark, both in tone and text. Perhaps only black metal can produce sounds that make me feel as just degraded and fucking hollow as Suicide in the Trenches. But again, this is one for the psychologists out there. That's exactly why I love it so much. I actively pursue experiences so bleak that I want to wrap myself in them like a blanket. Obleak it, perhaps. Okay, judging by your silence, perhaps not. But the lyrics, as I'm sure you heard, are simply these. I pull the trigger and say goodbye to this world. I say goodbye to this world. I say goodbye.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I...
Sorry, I just needed that. And to conclude, as promised, the denouement of the medley, once again, the last trench, with a soaring, wordless chorus and weeping guitar riff that seems to suggest a kind of sorrowful transcendence in the final moments of Marcel and Trouvé's life, while the heavy rasp of French black metal articulates the true human cost of the war with this. His name will be engraved on the marble, over there, in the marketplace, but he will soon be forgotten. Except by a crying girl. His war is finally over. This is his last trench. Something about the line, over there in the marketplace, is such an emotional dick punch to me. I know, I'm the Hemingway of heavy metal comedy podcasting. It's not only that the location of his grave is described as being adjacent to the events of his life and death, placing it over there, but also the final indignity of putting his marble headstone in the marketplace. It's the weight and significance of a human life contrasted with and relocated to a place of mindless superficiality, a square for commerce. It's the less ham-fisted version of turning the battlegrounds of the Marne into Disneyland Paris. Like, I just imagine some shitty French teenagers putting their empty Fanta cups on the headstone as they're leaving when the garbage can is right there. You don't litter on the dead, Jock. Which brings us to 1915, when we kind of have to leave the Western Front, because what happens in the trenches at the end of 1914 sort of just keeps going throughout 1915. In fact, not a lot happens on the Western Front until 1916 with the battles of Verdun and the Somme. And by not a lot, I mean not a lot of progress. A butt truck of people die, but none of that really moves the needle much until another evil German fuckface finds his way to turn stasis into strategy. But we'll get there. There's plenty of evil German fuckfaces in the interim. For now, let's check in on the Eastern Front, where Russia, who played starting forward for the Allies, was turning out to be sort of the Dennis Rodman of that alliance, a formidable opponent pulling down Hall of Fame rebound numbers, all while dressed in a full wedding gown. I mean, they were great, but were they okay? And they weren't. Running desperately low on ammunition and, like, food, there were massive internal labor strikes, chaotic social unrest, and one dangerously inebriated religious nutjob who wandered into St. Petersburg from the sticks of Siberia and in a matter of mere months was controlling the royal family's every move from the very darkest corners of the Alexander Palace. But we won't meet him yet. Just wanted to let you know that he's hovering in the background, actively plotting to steal your girlfriend. Just for the night, don't worry. Like 50 Cent, he's just into having sex. He ain't into making love. And if Russia was the Dennis Rodman of World War I, and I think I pretty well established that it was, on the other side of the conflict was the Ottoman Empire, the country that we now call Turkey, which was more like the Rod Dennisman of World War I, also a power forward in a wedding dress, but not in the NBA.
probably just your high school junior varsity team, where he put up some decent numbers, but mostly for the other team. The Ottoman Empire had been a pawn for the other European powers for decades, and had recently been cozying up to Germany after its assistance in the Balkan Wars of 1912, wherein Germany gladly armed and trained the Ottoman forces, who went on to lose over 80% of their territory to the combined armies of Serbia, Bulgaria, and Greece. Oh, and also Montenegro, but only in the movie version, because this isn't a real country. So the Ottoman Empire, fresh off of a humiliating loss to three smaller countries to the northwest, decides to launch an attack on the much larger country of Russia to the northeast, because what could possibly go wrong? And after a careful examination of the calendar, climate, geography, and history of war against Russia, they chose to launch the invasion in winter. So if you look at the map of the Russian and Ottoman empires in 2024, you can get a pretty good sense of how that went. 4 years after World War I, the Ottoman Empire, which had been founded by Donny and Marie Osman in the year 1285, ceased to exist. But right before they went out, they managed to gift the world with its first modern genocide, in which they systematically murdered somewhere between 600,000 and 1.2 million Armenians. The range of those numbers is obviously horrifying, and when I was trying to wrap my head around that upper limit of 1.2 million, I then read that the entire Armenian population in Turkey at the time was 1.5 million, meaning the Ottoman Empire came within about 300,000 people of wiping out their entire Armenian population. But they did not. They failed, which was kind of becoming their thing. A number of Armenian refugees then emigrated to the United States in hopes of their children and their children's children finding a better life by releasing a flawless five-record discography, all of which might achieve platinum status, three of which could reach number one on the U.S. Billboard charts. They might even win a Grammy for the most gonzo-brilliant song to probably ever win a Grammy criticizing the U.S.-led war in Iraq. High hopes. Specific hopes, but they fucking called it. Because in 1998, the band that would achieve all of this released their self-titled debut, including the album closer, Politically Lying, Unholy, Cowardly Killers, or PLUK, a brutal and plaintive attack against the Turkish government for their continuing refusal to acknowledge the genocide perpetrated against the band's very recent ancestors. They are one of the most innovative and inspired acts in all of heavy metal, ushering the genre into a new century with their multi-platinum magnum opus, Toxicity. This is System of a Down. Elimination. Elimination. We'll be right back. could have cut it down, but I didn't want to because why would I? System of a Down is probably the reason that I can't dismiss nu metal as an entire subgenre. A lot of the scat rapping bullshit from bands like Korn and Limp Bizkit comes from incorporating American hip-hop into the groove metal of the 90s from bands like Pantera. System unfortunately gets lumped in with nu metal, but it's rarely pointed out that their propensity for verbal gymnastics over up-tempo, semi-danceable beats doesn't come from American hip-hop. It doesn't even come from America. System's unique musical blueprint is a combination of progressive, alternative, and groove metal blended with the Armenian folk tradition. And it's weird that people don't make that point when talking about them, because you can hear it so clearly in their music. You can even hear it in their concerts. This is Darren Malkian, lead guitarist and co-vocalist slash songwriter for the band, in 2015, leading the audience in a traditional Armenian folk song that then transitions into one of his own. Take a listen. Disorder. Oh God, they are so brilliant. I would love to hear one more great System of a Down album, but I'm afraid that I never would. Just had too much time to think about it. But alas, onward. So, after getting their asses handed to them by Serbia, the Austro-Hungarian Empire goes crying to big brother Germany and his creepy little toady named Bulgaria, who's like a foot shorter than every other central power, but has a mad case of crazy eyes. Never bathes, never changes his clothes, but most of all, he just seems mean as fuck. And everybody's pretty sure he started smoking at 5. So with the advantage of numbers and armies that actually know how to fight, Austria-Hungary reinvades Serbia, and this time, the tiny Slavic nation that could, couldn't. Serbia gets absolutely crushed, and the bulk of its surviving forces flee to join with the British at Salonika, which I think is a dystopian film featuring Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman? Nope, sorry. It's Gattaca. Okay, then I don't know what Salonika is, but I do know that it's filled with a bunch of really sad Serbians. So maybe a hookah bar? Yeah, let's go with the hookah bar. And with Serbia now out of the way, Austria-Hungary can finally focus its full attention on Italy, who entered the war in May of 1915 and just started launching absolutely suicidal attacks at the Austrian border on the Alps, which is the beginning of the White War that we talked about on the last episode. The entrance of Italy into World War I actually turned out to be a galvanizing force for the Central Powers, as Austria-Hungary had long considered them to be their most hated enemy. Wait, wasn't Serbia their most hated enemy?
Yeah, we hated Serbia the most, and now we hate the Italy the most ever, even more the most ever.
All right, jeez, guys, take a day off with the hated enemies. What are you, Dave Mustaine?
Hey, I only have one most hated enemy.
Right. Wonder who that could be.
You know as well as I do. It's three doors down.
Three doors down? I thought you were going to say Metallica.
No, I don't hate Metallica. I am Metallica. I wrote all their best stuff. If I hated Metallica, that would mean the thing I hated most in life was really myself.
Are you going to point out the significance of what you just said, or do you want me to?
Why don't you go point out your stupid shit face? Now you're my most hated enemy.
See you later. See you later, Dave.
So yeah, with Serbia out of the way, Austria-Hungary had to find a new most hated enemy to lose badly to, and that was Italy. By the end of 1914, the dual monarchy had lost over 1 million men, and by March, they had racked up over 800,000 more in the White War, bringing the country to the brink of collapse. And there are quite a few metal albums that focus on this subject specifically. This is one of the reasons why I love metal so much. I found like 4 or 5 albums just on the battles that took place between Italy and Austria-Hungary on the Alps. And not all of those bands were Italian either. Heavy metal has developed such a culture of specificity and support that bands can devote entire albums to ancillary battles during a war that happened over 100 years ago, and fans are like,
hell yeah, I gotta hear more about the conflict over the Dolomites from May 1915 to November 1918.
Like, what other genre of music does that? It's just awesome.
We're the best.
And here is a song by one of those bands, Speculum Mortis, who does happen to be from Italy. On their 2018 LP on the White War, Fate tutti il vostro dovere. I hope you saw how much my hands were moving. Anyway, it roughly translates to, all must do their duty. And here it is. Meanwhile, as the former head of the German forces, Helmut von Moltke, was busy peeing fingernails into mason jars, nope, I'm just gonna keep going, a shiny new evil German fuckface had stepped up to take his place. His name was Erich von Falkenhayn. And he realized part of his force would have to remain on the Alpine border because the kid leash they kept Austria-Hungary on could only stretch so far. But watching the Austro-Hungarians and Italians send wave after wave of men to their freezing deaths at the top of the world gave Falkenhayn a really neat idea.
What if the strategy in this war that has failed to produce an advantage for either side, no matter how many lives we throw at it, actually is the strategy? Maybe this war wasn't meant to be won. Maybe it was meant to be forever. On the side that loses is the first one to feel the pangs of their humanity.
Oh, that's some evil shit, Erich. You've really outdone yourself this time, you soulless monster. I think somebody just earned himself 2 scoops of vanilla ice cream. In a waffle cone? Oh!
Okay, new to-do list. 1. Usher in era of unjustifiably cruel modern warfare. 2. Get vanilla ice cream. Scratch that. 1. Get chocolate ice cream. 2. Then do the horrible war thing. Oh, Erich, you evil German fuckface, you.
And so Erich von Falkenhayn decided to test his new theory of battle in the laboratories of the Western Front. His tactics had now shifted from the traditional goal of taking and holding more enemy territory to instead baiting the Allies into bleeding themselves to death. And he thought he just might have found the perfect location for it. A little city on the banks of the Meuse River in northern France called Verdun. And when we come back, we will dig into the longest single conflict in World War I, where the man who would come to be called the Blood Miller of Verdun, dated her, Erich von Falkenhayn, would introduce the world to the then novel concept that would come to be known as Abnutzungskrieg. Boy, it just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? Or a war of attrition. When we come back. That was the 2005 Grammy Award winner that I mentioned earlier called BYOB off of the first disc of System of a Down's final and double album, Mesmerize, Hypnotize. No, it's not a World War I song. It's actually an Iraq War song, but come on. What am I going to do, an entire series on just music about World War I? Okay, back to Verdun. Or as it was known by the many who participated in it, the Hell of Verdun. The city's name actually means strong fort in Gaulish, and that's just what it was, a small, heavily fortified town with no real strategic advantage, but Falkenhayn hoped he could dupe the Allies into believing that Germany thought it was, and that he could mount an assault on Verdun but never capture it, instead allowing the Allies to pour men and resources into a battle that would, quote, bleed the French white. After the war, the Battle of Verdun was thought by many to be World War I's bloodiest, but it only went to number 8 on the Billboard charts of mortality. The participation trophy for the bloodiest battle of World War I actually belongs to the Brusilov Offensive between Russia and the Central Powers that cost the world 2.2 million casualties in about 3.5 months. What Verdun was, however, is probably the most consistently bloody of the war's battles, which saw an average of over 300,000 French and German casualties every month for the span of 9.5 months. It's not that Verdun was more deadly than other theaters of war, it's that the battle turned human casualty into a mechanical process. It was precise and regular, like an assembly line but for disassembling people. And this is when soldiers started referring to fighting on the Western Front as if it were a machine, describing deployment to Verdun as going into the grinder. And yes, that is grinder spelled with an E. Don't be childish. That's why I'm here. As I was putting together Eine Kleine Medley for Verdun, I started noticing the sheer volume of heavy music on the topic. There is the album Verdun, with an exclamation mark by FT-17, and Verdun 1916 by Neurosis, not the sludgy post-metal Neurosis and not my own personal Neurosis, a different Neurosis, out of Colombia. And finally, just Verdun, without the exclamation mark, because it's a drone metal album by a band called Blackbone Angel, and drone metal is not really an exclamation mark kind of a subgenre. More like an ellipse. And then another. And then another. And then another. And then another, and on like that for the better part of an hour. Kind of felt like I'd been through Verdun when it was over, actually. And then I went looking for individual songs about Verdun, and found some called The Ghosts of Verdun, and The Battle of Verdun, Verdun Meat Grinder, The Fields of Verdun, In the Fields of Verdun, The Hell of Verdun, Another The Hell of Verdun, as well as Hell on the Western Line, and then in parentheses, Verdun. There was also Fortress of Verdun, Last Man at Verdun, and Verdun on the Meuse, and at least 12 different songs called simply Verdun, when I had to stop looking because at that point my brain was officially Verdun. This period of nearly 10 months in our recent history has clearly left a psychological scar on us as a species. And one of the reasons it's such a particular focus for this devoted niche of musicians is because Verdun is really a symbol for World War I as a whole. Not only are both sides just mechanically sending thousands of men to their death for absolutely zero strategic gain, on at least one side of the conflict, it's being done on purpose. History doesn't really record Erich von Falkenhayn as the Hans Landa that I've made him out to be, because he's actually explicit in his writings that he doesn't think the war can be won by taking enemy territory, and was quietly advocating for peace terms to no avail. So his war of attrition was actually an attempt to conclude the conflict. But you have to wonder why, right? The logic there just does not add up to me. This war is truly terrible, and we must bring an end to it by making it as terrible as we possibly can. It's not going to be easy, but the killing has to stop. And I am personally willing to kill at least 700,000 people to stop it. But not one man over a million. We must think of our humanity, after all. I should have gone with the vanilla. I just don't get this post-facto reasoning trying to justify killing people so that we don't have to kill more people. But there was no other way to end the war. Oh, really? Resign. Tell all your friends to resign. Or organize yourselves to demand a course correction. Or just fucking walk away. Take your savings, go to Iceland, and become a sheep farmer. And that's just me thinking about it for 20 seconds. You had 4 years. Did it ever occur to you that you didn't have to participate in the war? I mean, just uber-fuck all of these assholes and their travel-sized imaginations. There's a reason that guys like Falkenhayn became generals. They have no ability to think beyond the parameters that are given to them by someone else. In fact, the more limited the thinking, the better. That way, they can channel both of those huge brain cells into finding new and exciting ways to murder people. 9. The only way to stop this war is to keep it going forever. Die in a fire, you gutless fuckbasket. All right, I'm done yelling at imaginary World War I generals. Usually a weekend thing for me anyway. So without further ado, here are some people who are even more pissed off about Verdun than me, beginning with self-described one guy in a basement from Omaha, Nebraska. This is Doomsayer with the intro to a song called Into the Grinder.
Thank you. descend into darkness. 303 days below the sun feels overdone. And the battle has begun. No way to run. Father, son, fall one by one. Under the gun, now you will be done. And the judgment has begun. No way to run. Father, son, fall one by one. Feels overdone.
Father, death is your home. Sleep on me.
So that was a song by 1914, which you heard at the top of this episode as well. This is one of over a dozen Verduns that I found. And lyrically, the song reflects the rather bleak nature of its namesake. It begins, "Like scum of earth, like dust on shoes, despair, despond." Train. Oh, no, sorry, that's just the sound of a train. I really love the, I won't say broken English of their lyrics, because I think one of the defining features of English is its ability to adapt to new influences. You can't really break English because it just keeps bending as we've added to it over the past 1,400 years. Not to mention, his English is about a billion times better than my Ukrainian. But like taking the indefinite article out of scum of the earth and making it just scum of earth and turning despondent into a verb, it just shapes those ideas in a unique way to me. Despond is an English word, but it's an archaic one that we don't really use anymore, and hearing it in that way makes me reconsider what I thought it was. Not the state of being despondent, but the action of desponding, desponding over or because of something. I watched an interview with Dimitra Kumar, the lead singer of 1914, and he doesn't try to correct himself or apologize when he gets tangled up in an English phrase, so I think it's semi-intentional. He also swears a lot and loves to describe things as shitty. A love we share. There's also a great line toward the end of the track that reads, "In Verdun's mud, fairness does not exist. You are just a piece of meat in the grinder of senseless war. Invoking the concept of fairness is really affecting. It's not justice or grace or any of the other more complicated human constructs. It's one of the first things that we teach children as a value in all cultures. Well, some of us do. Fairness, right? Two kids, two apples, each kid gets an apple. Two kids, one apple, they split it. Fairness. I don't know why we don't have more apples. That's not the point. We teach ourselves to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. But that basic universal human value breaks down in the grinder of Verdun. This is the longest fucking train I have ever heard in my life. It just keeps going. Okay, and now our train has ended. And that idea is reflected in a lot of the letters home from soldiers in World War I. Who is spared and who is not, and why? To borrow a phrase, there's some gold star material coming up here, so consider yourself forewarned. One French soldier on the lines in 1916 wrote, "You must know that we are at the environs of Verdun. What carnage. It is horrible to see what we are seeing. We have been here now for 12 days, and every day we have serious losses. I consider myself lucky to have escaped up to now." Other descriptions were far more vivid. "Anyone who has not seen these fields of carnage will never be able to imagine it. One has to go out of one's way not to pass over a corpse lying at the bottom of a communication trench. Others are carried back on stretchers to the rear. Some are screaming. Others are pleading. One sees some who don't have any legs, others without heads, who have been left for several weeks on the ground. For some, the specter of death served only as a reminder that they had merely been spared for now. As one letter reads, it is a war of brute material, and when everything appears dead, and when the survivors have been reduced to a state of madness, they send those masses out to attack. And if there's only 10 out of 100 left, those 10 will fight on. For others, their survival was a call to endurance, by whatever means necessary, no matter how pedestrian the comfort. One soldier wrote, "I stayed 10 days next to a man who was chopped in two. There was no way to move him. He had one leg in the parapet and the rest of his body in the trench. It stank, and I had to chew tobacco the whole time in order to endure this torment." But by far the most common sentiment I read in the letters from Verdun were questions of the meaning and the duration of the fight, namely, concerning when it would end. From June 1916, "One has to have a strong heart to endure such martyrdom. This is not war. It's a massacre. When will it end? It's terrible to see what is happening." Another from the same period says, "It's an unending hell. It is solitude in all its horror. When will this veritable martyrdom end?" A possible answer to those questions came after the war from a French general recalling the men he commanded at Verdun. The memory of his surviving soldiers made it clear that ultimately, no one was spared. The dead did not survive it, and the living could never leave it. He wrote, "Their expressions seemed frozen by a vision of horror. Their gait and postures betrayed a total dejection. They sagged beneath the weight of their horrible memories." All right, let's get back to talking about music, shall we? That first track by Doomsayer does have lyrics, but you only heard the instrumental opening, so the first words that I played were by a band called Sabaton. I promise you power metal. I give you power metal. Sabaton is a Swedish band, and not just any Swedish band. They are one of the biggest power metal bands in the world. Their 2012 album Carolus Rex was a quadruple platinum record in Sweden, and they've scored gold records in Finland and Poland as well. They also regularly appear on the US Billboard charts, a feat that cannot be claimed even by the biggest names in power metal history, Germany's Blind Guardian and Helloween. The Swedish power metalers are also, as you just heard, a little silly. They seem like the band other power metal guys snicker about when they're not around, but like in falsetto. It's a very disturbing snicker. You really gotta shake it, you know? Because that motherfucker clings. That said, they have made multiple albums on the subject of World War I and World War II with their own brand of hyper-macho, fist-pumping manthems, as well as a fully functional tank that fires blanks into the crowd at their live shows. Let's just all pray Alec Baldwin is never asked to join the band. And yeah, maybe they're not the most legit example of power metal, but they are absolutely the most legit example of World War I-themed power metal. And these Bjorn bros know their history. The lyrics of the song Fields of Verdun that you heard contain the lines, "A million shells were fired," and 303 days under the sun, both of which are accurate. Germany did fire a million artillery shells on the first day of the battle and reduced what was a verdant, forested area to basically a post-apocalyptic wasteland. A number of soldiers pointed out in their letters home the absence of trees in what was previously a forest. It's really something to behold if you look at the before and the after pictures, which I don't recommend. As to the accuracy, I didn't see any evidence that a father and son both died in Verdun, but, I don't know, father and son, but not necessarily the son of that particular father, doesn't really fit into the AAAAAAA rhyme scheme that Sabaton has going. No, they are not my particular cup of testosterone, and I don't think many of my friends and listeners who love power metal would even put them in their top 10, but I appreciate the intention, even if I don't enjoy the music. Finally, another French black metal band, there's a lot of those in this series, Asiard, with the song, wait for it. Okay, why are you just sitting there not saying anything? Oh, you were waiting for it. Oh, I'm sorry, no, I didn't mean that, literally. That's right, the song is called Verdun, and they haven't posted any lyrics for it on Spotify, Bandcamp, Facebook, YouTube, or their own website, so again, I'll just assume it's about a hookah bar. So to put a blood-soaked bow on the Battle of Verdun, Falkenhayn's War of Attrition was a rousing success in the eyes of exactly one person, Erich von Falkenhayn. He was convinced that the French-to-German casualty ratio was 5-2, because of course it would be a mathematical formula. That's just what good people do. In reality, the ratio was more like 1-1. When the battle ended in December, the French had lost roughly 163,000 lives to the Germans' 143,000. They hadn't taken any territory of value, and the Allies launched a counterattack at the Somme in July that forced Germany to redirect its forces. So Falkenhayn was summarily sacked and spent the rest of his days arguing that sucking shit was actually his plan all along, including in his memoirs that I'm certain is a real page-turner for anyone who loves dead assholes that accomplish nothing in their life except making everything worse. A letter he wrote to the German Emperor in Christmas of 1916, in which he said, "Within our reach there are objectives for the retention of which the French General Staff would be compelled to throw every man they have. If they do so, the forces of France will bleed to death." Cool story, Eric. But it turns out, he never actually wrote that letter. He just made it up after the fact so as to create the appearance that he actually knew what he was doing. But here's the thing. The French at Verdun were absolute goddamn heroes. The French take a lot of shit, especially in the States for surrendering too soon and all kinds of crap for their conduct in the war. But this is a quote from an actual French commander to his troops during Verdun. Listen to this. "You have a mission of sacrifice. Here is a post of honor where they want to attack. Every day, you will have casualties. On the day they want to, they will massacre you to the last man. And it is your duty to fall." Yeah, but I don't want to. I don't want to glorify it because those are people sacrificing themselves for literally fucking nothing. But that is an incredible reserve of courage to have, to face something like that and continue to walk forward. I wish I had an ounce of the courage that that required. But I don't, because I'm a physical coward. Anyway, back to Falkenhayn. Yeah, he sucked, but his daughter married a guy who was one of the German generals that tried to assassinate Hitler. So good things did come out of his existence. He just didn't have anything to do with any of them. Well, Mother Punchers, I don't know about you, but that sure felt like an A-side to me. And when we flip this black wax of tracks over to the B-side, we will talk about the battle that emerged out of Verdun, lasting roughly half as long, but costing nearly twice as many lives, the Battle of the Somme, which began on July 1st, 1916, a day that remains the single deadliest in the history of the British Army. And I don't think there is any band in the history of heavy metal more capable of transitioning us into such a somber topic with the maturity, gravity, and grace required for such a segue than the one and the only Motorhead. Wait, Motorhead? Seriously? I gotta check this. Yeah, shit, it says Motorhead. All right, me from a week ago. I trust your judgment. After all, you are the man who coined the name Satanic. Your gifts are not of an age, but for all time. Or maybe you suck and you just got lucky. I don't know, but we'll all find out soon enough when we come back. Take it away, Lemmy.
16 years old when I went to the war to fight for a land fit for heroes. God on my side and a gun in my hand, chasing my days down to zero. And I marched and I fought and I bled and I died, and I never did get any older. But I knew at the time that a year in the line was a long enough life for a soldier. We all volunteered and we wrote down our names, and we added 2 years to our ages. Eager for life and ahead of the game, ready for history's pages. And we brawled and we fought and we hoard till we stood 10,000 shoulder to shoulder. A thirst for the Hun, we were food for the gun. And that's what you are when you're sold.